You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan prepares to test the mood of voters at local elections. The case for keeping massive sports arenas in the heart of cities and Beyoncé goes country. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house daily, and this Good Friday, those Monocle staffers who proved most amenable to bribery with chocolate bunny rabbits were Hannah Lucinda Smith, Laura Kramer, Carlotta Ribello and Steph Chungu. They will discuss the day's stuff, and at Monocle's latest Chiefs Conference in Hong Kong, we'll meet the Indonesian actor and director Dian Sastrowardoyo. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle Radio. On Sunday, Turks will vote in local elections, the first electoral test of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan since his re-election last year. The state of Turkey's built environment was an issue in that election, especially following the destruction wrought by the earthquake of early 2023, which levelled thousands of rickety buildings, and urban redevelopment will loom large among the concerns of voters this weekend. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's Istanbul correspondent Hannah Lucinda Smith, who is still here in the studio prior to flying back to Istanbul. Hannah, first of all, urban development is very much a thing for Erdogan, isn't it? Like all kind of autocrats and autocrat-adjacent politicians, he enjoys building stuff. I think people are probably familiar with his gazillion-room palace in Ankara, but it's not just that, is it?
Yeah, I mean, particularly in the past 10 years of Erdogan's tenure, it's really become a huge marker of his style of rule. And it serves several purposes for him. The first is, you mentioned the thousand-room palace. On top of that, we've got a whole host of world's biggest. We've got the world's biggest airport in Istanbul that he built. I think it opened in 2019. New bridges, new tunnels under the Bosphorus, huge new roads. And whenever Erdogan goes on the campaign trail, whether it's personally in presidential elections or whether it's for local elections like the ones coming up on Sunday, he makes a lot of them. Usually he'll go around cutting ribbons on new infrastructure projects while he's doing that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that he's built a really complex and strong patronage network of businessmen who support him, and most of those have at least some interest in construction. What you'll find in companies in Turkey, a lot of companies are these kind of huge conglomerates. They have arms that span everything from media to construction, transport, sometimes defence. And what happens is that Erdogan will give these businessmen and these companies huge contracts for the state projects, and in return, they will use their media outlets to support him. So he's built up this kind of patronage network through construction. On top of that also, construction is one of the only things that's really kept the Turkish economy growing at quite some speed at some point in the past few years. Turkey is in a huge economic crisis. It's a massive mess, mostly of Erdogan's own making. But if you look at the growth figures on paper, the economy is still growing, overheated, some analysts would say. And that's largely down to the construction sector, the lending that comes along with that, and people being encouraged to take out loans to buy their own houses and just to keep that sector going.
I mean, politicians and leaders generally with delusions of grandeur have been attempting to make their mark on Istanbul for centuries. In the 11 years you've lived there now, what kind of impact has Erdogan had on it, for good and for bad? This was, of course, the city that he was mayor of before becoming president.
Yeah, so, I mean, the first big infrastructure project that I remember opening was in 2013, just a few months after I'd arrived there, to mark what was then the 90-year anniversary of the Turkish Republic. And that was the Marmaray that goes, it's a tunnel that goes underneath the Bosphorus. It's a road tunnel, it's also a rail tunnel, and it's actually very useful. It really cut down the kind of travelling times, because prior to that, the only way that you could get across was either on the road bridges, incredibly congested, or going across on a ferry. It takes quite some time. But then on top of that, over the years, more and more has been added. So now a third bridge over the Bosphorus, that's right up at the Black Sea end. I've used it a couple of times, and both times absolutely empty, both the bridge itself and the kind of new motorway leading to it. It's the fees are absolutely huge. No one uses it. It's just a very, very useful shortcut if all the other bridges are busy and you fancy sort of going a huge loop out of your way. Also, the airport, which I mentioned, that hugely controversial. The plans for that, you know, partly contributed to the Gezi Park protests kicking off in 2013. Huge amount of protected forest land destroyed for that. And then on top of that, there are the more kind of residential, smaller scale projects. What we have in Istanbul is something called an urban zoning law. This was brought in to, it was meant to be about earthquake safety. So the city is zoned and certain zones are designated as high risk, meaning that the government can seize whatever's there and hand it over to developers to be redeveloped, hopefully in a safe way. What's actually happened is that the areas that have a nice view of the Bosphorus or are close to some of the few parks that are left, desirable parcels of land, they're the ones that have been taken. Areas cleared, usually fairly poor areas, what we call in Turkish Gece Kondu, they're sort of informally built areas, working class districts cleared, and then these huge new districts built in their place. There's one very near to where I live called Fikirtepe. It was, a Gece Kondu district. It was just very, very working class, normal Turks living there, compulsorily purchased under this law, handed to builders, and now it's these almost dystopian huge towers which are almost empty. I've had a couple of friends who've spent periods living in them, and they say it's just the weirdest thing because you're sort of cut off from street life. There's really no one there. And just last year, one of them caught fire quite dramatically. It wasn't, you know, sort of quite as appalling as Grenfell. I think there were a few people injured, nobody killed, thank goodness. But that sort of really shone a light on, you know, the kind of flaws that are built into some of these new developments.
As I mentioned in the introduction, of course, the earthquake of February last year was a reminder where it needed of how much modern Turkish building has been done with little regard to any kind of building codes. It is a truism among, you know, building engineers that earthquakes themselves don't actually kill people. It tends to be the state of the building built on top of the earthquake zone. Has there been any lessons learned from that? Because obviously there's a huge task of reconstruction has been necessary in the earthquake affected areas, but what do we know about whether the replacements of those buildings are going to be more resilient to the next earthquake? Because there will be another earthquake.
There will. And, you know, certainly in Istanbul, we're expecting it. Istanbul lies on a major fault line. You look back over its history, every couple of hundred years, it's basically destroyed and rebuilt. If we're going to talk about lessons learned, I think we can break it down into several things. The first of those things is the idea of getting justice for the shoddy building that was done, not sticking to building regulations, which are actually there in Turkey. Mm. The laws are in place. Now, interestingly, Human Rights Watch just today released a report saying that although contractors, private businessmen are being prosecuted, nobody at the official level has yet been punished or been held to task for the fact that rampant corruption has allowed constructors to build pretty much what they want, where they want. So there is a sense that, you know, justice is not being done. But in terms of lessons being learned, so what happened in Istanbul after those February earthquakes last year was immediately everyone panicked, and there was a huge rush of people trying to get resilience tests for their buildings. The municipality in Istanbul opened up free building tests. I think it had about 100,000 applications within a few weeks. But then what happened after that is a very Turkish response, let's say. People started doing the tests. Obviously, a lot of buildings were failing, and then people were realising, oh, I'm going to have to move out of my house. Mm. And Istanbul's housing prices were already rocketing. It is classically in countries where the currency is devaluing, people tend to flee to property or to stocks. And that's exactly what's happened in Turkey, and particularly in Istanbul. So already there was a housing crisis. And suddenly you got lots of arguments between neighbours in the same block, some neighbours wanting to do the building test and others saying like, oh, no, but I've got nowhere to go. I don't want to have to rent a new house. So it's caused quite a bit of friction. There are, as you walk around Istanbul these days, it is astonishing how many buildings are being pulled down. And, you know, the construction dust almost hangs thick in the air. So I think certainly, you know, it was a huge shock for people. It shouldn't have been a shock because we all knew something was coming. But I think it's really sort of, you know, sharpened people's minds about the risk that Istanbul is facing.
Anna Lucinda Smith, thank you. You're back with the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined now in the studio by Monocle producer and entertainment correspondent Laura Kramer and by Monocle's senior foreign correspondent and producer of The Urbanist, Carlotta Rebello. Hello to you both.
Hi.
I was going to start by asking you what your big Easter plans are, but that's fairly self-evident. You're here.
We are working all weekend, actually, Andrew. So thank you so much for bringing that up.
It's just a regular weekend, Andrew. What are your plans?
Well, I too, Carlotta, as you may have noticed, here.
Wow. We are very lucky. It is a Good Friday.
It is a Good Friday. No one's bought us an egg. I was assuming that management would leave like a massive chocolate egg, unless there was one here earlier today and you all ate it before
I arrived. I thought the producer was in charge of the egg. I think we need to have words after the show.
We will. Chris, it's your fault. We don't have an egg. You didn't produce an egg. This is fascinating for the listeners, me talking to the producer in the production booth who can't answer back.
You know what? The only thing I'd say is that Chris loves white chocolate, and I don't think I would be on board with a white chocolate egg, as lovely as this gesture
would be. This is good introductory banter. This is controversial. I like this. Laura, do you have views on white chocolate?
Yeah, I actually hate it.
Really?
And can I just tell you, a recent poll showed that it actually is worse for the environment than other chocolates. This was a poll done by the Swiss, of course.
On what basis?
It was actually on chocolate bunnies themselves.
Mm. Like how is white chocolate worse for the environment than not white chocolate?
If you think about it, it's got more dairy, you know, milk chocolate. So the ranking goes white chocolate, milk chocolate, and the best one for the environment in terms of all the production that goes into it is actually dark chocolate, which is my favorite.
My favorite too. Oh, I love this.
See, I do like dark chocolate, but controversially, I do not at all mind white chocolate.
Wow, I don't think we can reach an agreement here.
It lies. There's no cocoa in it. It is a fake. I'm sorry. You've really triggered something in me.
Clearly. And it won't be the last time with any luck. is there anybody with an idea about how we can do a seamless pivot from white chocolate versus dark chocolate to the merits of downtown football stadiums?
I have a sort of transition here.
Go on, let's try.
So the person that prefers the white chocolate is Chris Chermak. And Chris Chermak has what for us, Andrew?
He has written a monologue for us, Carlotta.
Tell me all
brilliantly,
about it.
Brilliantly, brilliantly done. I will now tell you all about it. That was liquid segueing there, Carlotta. Thank you. The US capital, yes, of Washington, D.C., is this week celebrating the rescue of its primary downtown sports and entertainment venue. Washington's mayor, Muriel Bowser, has reached a deal with Ted Leonsis, owner of the Washington Capitals and the Washington Wizards, to keep the teams downtown until at least 2050, marking a reversal of fortunes after their owner had planned to move the entire operation to Virginia. Monocle's white chocolate enjoying Chris Chermak explains.
Off the face of the Capitals have won it!
I remember the first time I went to Washington's main downtown sports venue in an area called Gallery Place. It was known as the Verizon Center at the time, now the Capital One Arena, and the city's ice hockey team, the Washington Capitals, were such an unknown entity that I'd literally been sent free tickets to see one of their games in the mail. This was in the mid-2000s, and Washington was desperate to bring people to this new downtown area of Gallery Place, just about half a mile from the White House. The area grew to become one of Washington's primary hotspots, and the Capitals became one of the biggest names in ice hockey, winning the Stanley Cup in 2018. It was a positive story of city development until it wasn't. Gallery Place and Washington's downtown in general have suffered in recent years, particularly after the pandemic. So much so that Ted Leonsis, the owner of the Capitals and the city's basketball team, the Washington Wizards, earlier this year reached a deal with Virginia's governor to move his teams to a sprawling new $2.2 billion mixed-use venue to be built across the Potomac River in Alexandria, Virginia. Washington, D.C.'s residents were heartbroken because it meant not only the loss of two sports teams, but that business developers were basically giving up on Washington's downtown. But this week, there was a surprise reversal. After Virginia's legislature hesitated on approving the cost of their own governor's deal, Washington's mayor, Muriel Bowser, swooped in. Mayor Bowser reached her own agreement with Ted Leonsis to keep the teams and their stadium in Gallery Place until at least 2050, promising more than $500 million of city funds to refurbish the arena over the next 3 years. Crucially, the deal also tries to address Ted Leonsis' concerns about the downward spiral of Washington's downtown. There will be a guaranteed minimum police presence, and Leonsis has also agreed to redevelop the Gallery Place retail center nearby. Leonsis says he was also heartened by Washington's recently adopted plans to revive the downtown and passage of a bill to tackle crime more broadly. And the fact that Mayor Bowser moved so quickly is a sign of just how much this stadium means to the future of Washington's downtown. You won't get free tickets to see the games anymore these days, I can tell you that. For Monocle, I'm Chris Chermak.
Thank you, Chris. What we wanted to broaden this out into was a discussion of whether or not it is a good thing that venues stay downtown. And Laura, I was reminded recently of exactly this debate by discourse that occurred over Taylor Swift's recent shows at the Melbourne Cricket Ground in Melbourne, because aerial views of the venue appeared on social media and Americans were baffled that there is no visible car parking around the Melbourne Cricket Ground. And Australians were having to explain, well, it's right next to downtown. You can basically just walk along the river in 15 minutes, or there's a train station, or you can get a tram. Your people seemed bewildered by these thoughts.
Well, I think, and probably Carlotta can speak a little bit more on this, but in the U.S., especially for stadiums, there are laws around having a certain amount of parking lot space for cars, and it's usually very big.
Mm.
And so it doesn't surprise me. I remember seeing the videos and especially seeing how quickly they could shovel all these amounts of people on this public transport, which again, public transport in America isn't that great, especially in a lot of cities. And I think there is a difference here because America is a young nation, as is Australia, but, you know, compared to, for example, Europe, which is many, many centuries older than those. And they did have sports stadiums. You know, we have the Colosseum in Rome and everything. And they decided then to build newer stadiums outside of the cities, whereas America is newer. We do have some old stadiums. I'm thinking about Wrigley, you know, Red Sox, Fenway, and things like that. And then the city grows around them. But in general, because we are younger, at the same time, we built them outside, and we have the wide roads and all the parking that you have to take into account. And so I think that makes... that's probably where that confusion came in from.
Except Australia is quite young, and the Melbourne Cricket Ground just got parked there in the mid-19th century, and it's still there now. It's bigger than it used to be. But Carlotta, you are here with your urbanist hat on. Literally, it's one of those novelty ones, listeners, with antlers, and it says the urbanist across the front of it. Where are you on the idea of whether stadiums should be in the middle of a city or banished to the outskirts?
Well, so it's really curious that you asked me that, Andrew, because just last week I hosted a sports roundtable on The Urbanist, exactly dedicated to stadium and sporting development and the benefits they have for cities. And I asked my panel precisely this question. And we got some interesting comments because, of course, the location of a stadium is what matters the most because, you know, you want people to be able to get to and from with ease. But if you think about when a stadium is in use, you know, let's say it's one day of the weekend, of every weekend in the year, that would be, what, 52 times. And, you know, if it's, for example, a football or in this case, Laura, soccer stadium, that will be, you know, you'd have away games. So let's say it's half of that. So what happens to the stadium for the vast majority of the time when nothing is happening there in terms of people coming into the venue. For example, that question about the parking, it really reminded me of the example of the LAFC stadium, the soccer team in Los Angeles. They built a new stadium in the Exposition Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. And their whole thing was that when the stadium was inaugurated and built, it had to be tapped into the public transport. And because of that allowance, the requirement for parking that Laura mentioned there was halved by the municipality because it had this direct connection to public transit. And I remember I was there at the time as bureau chief, and it was unbelievably shocking, this idea that people could come to and from, were encouraged, in fact, in Los Angeles, such a car-centric city, to actually use public transit. But in that case, it was actually good that it wasn't plonked in the middle of downtown, that it was bringing life to this new neighborhood. You know, other services appeared around it, including the access to the metro. So that is where a case for detaching a stadium from the center of a city can be made. You know, here in London, for example, if you think of what could be described as the national stadium, Wembley. Mm. You know, there is a lot of consideration about what happens around the area when it's not in use. That's why it's used maybe for concerts outside of sporting activities, why there's tours that can happen of the arena. And you don't go there now, imagine today, a day where, actually, I don't know if anyone is playing, but let's go. For this example, I'd say no one is playing there today at this time. If you go there, there will be life around it. What you don't want is to build one of these mega infrastructures that only functions when the team is playing at home.
I did want to wrap up this conversation by asking everybody at the table to name a particular sporting venue, if indeed you already have one. I am going to stick with the Melbourne Cricket Ground, which is fantastic. It is like they've actually thought about how to get large numbers of people in and out of a place. It has an extraordinary history, which it does actually celebrate within the precinct of the MCG. The Australian Sports Museum is housed within the stadium, and you can go and visit that anytime, not on match days. But the great thing about the MCG is because it is so enormous, I think it's the 10th biggest stadium in the world, holds about 100,000 people. It's really only full twice a year, once on the Australian Football League's grand final day, occasionally on the first day of the Boxing Day test match, depending on who Australia are playing, which means for almost any other game there, you can basically wander up a few minutes before it starts and get in for maybe $20. It's fantastic. Laura, I think you may already have mentioned your favourite in passing.
Well, yeah, I do. I think Wembley Stadium, it holds a very, Wembley in general holds a very, very special place in my heart because I am a long suffering, Carlotta and I should say, we actually went to see the Spice Girls there.
True.
Together. And that was an incredible experience. And also trying to get out of Wembley Stadium after the Spice Girls was an experience.
It took nearly as long as the whole concert.
Yeah, this is the difference. I often reflect on this difference between the Melbourne Cricket Ground and Wembley Stadium. At Melbourne, they seem to have thought of how are we going to get 100,000 people out of here? Whereas at Wembley, they just always seem surprised that, oh my God, all these people have turned up.
Yeah, it's shocking how it happened. But I do want to say, just because of the little comment earlier about soccer versus football. Very rude, Carlotta. Very sneaky.
I just wanted to make sure everyone knew what type of football I was referring to.
Yeah, I just want to say that I am a fan of the Emirates Stadium because I'm an Arsenal fan. Mm-hmm. That's right. But the place that holds my heart is Wrigley Field in Chicago because that's where I cried on many occasions as a long-suffering Cubs fan. And I will say another one that is actually downtown in Chicago is the Chicago Bulls United Center. It is really in the city and it is very accessible. And I did watch Michael Jordan play there once, so holds a special place in my heart.
Carlotta, do you have a favourite, just quickly?
Well, there's one that always comes to mind. It's back in Portugal, and it's not of a team, it's not of my team, nor even my region of the country, but it's in Braga, which is in the north of the country. It was built for when Portugal hosted the Euros 2004, designed by Eduardo Sotomora, the Pritzker Prize winning architect, and it's literally carved into the mountain, and it's such a spectacular stadium to to watch whatever it is, be it sports or cultural, a concert or something, just because if you're there at the end of the day when the sun is setting, is literally reflecting against the mountain, and it's just so, so stunning. Yeah, it's beautiful. I've never had the privilege to actually watch something there myself live, but every time I've watched something through the TV, I want to one day be able to go to that stadium. And it's just beautifully designed, as you would expect with anything designed by Eduardo Soto de Moura.
Well, moving along somewhat, the citizens of these islands have this week been in receipt of two spectacular examples of the kind of public health advice issued in the grim certainty that absolutely nobody is going to pay attention to it. The Foreign Office has cautioned English and Scottish football fans thinking of travelling to Germany for the European Football Championships this summer that the local brew is stronger than what they are used to at home. The Foreign Office may merely just have sold a few more tickets. More pertinently to today's date, an NHS doctor has solemnly counselled against eating an entire Easter egg in a single sitting. Ironically, the popular response has been to tell him to cram it. Carlotta, first of all, is there a great deal of point in warnings of this sort? I don't think anybody who drinks strong lager or yams an Easter egg is doing so in the belief that it's going to do them any good.
I feel like these warnings are almost like inviting the answer of challenge accepted, you know? That's the only way I can really view these warnings, because I don't think... First of all, if you're going to drink 15 pints, it doesn't matter if it's beer lager or, you know, if it's British lager or German lager, you're going to have some serious side effects. And the same if you decide to eat a large amount of Easter eggs. So I don't know if these warnings are actually going to deter anyone.
I kind of wonder if it's the Foreign Office trying to signal to these, to Germany and, you know, whatever country English football fans go to, like, hey, we tried. We told them. It's like them watching their hands a little bit, like, we know they get rowdy, sorry about that, but we did say it's really, you know, hard beer.
Have you, Laura, ever knowingly altered your own behavior because of any sort of public health warning of any kind?
I don't think so, to be honest with you. I'm a very health conscious person. Maybe if something came out about wine, I would be willing to take it on board. I do think it's funny, though, there's been this weird kind of reaction here, specifically to the chocolate thing. Now, for listeners who might be familiar with one politician in the UK, one Nigel Farage, he's a populist politician, if I need to explain that to anybody.
Is he pretending to be angry about it for money? Is that what is happening?
That's right. Health warnings are too woke for him.
Oh,
and I just have to say, he's throwing a little temper tantrum about it because he loathes this patronizing tone. And, you know, what a crybaby he is, because, our world's hurting your feelings, Nigel. I mean, I just think that he imagines this doctor that traveled to his evil lair, which I'm assuming is like underground in a complex beneath a swamp somewhere. And he single-handedly took out the chocolate and was like, you can't do that. That's what the reaction has been. And now he says, well, I'm definitely going to eat a full Easter egg to myself this weekend.
We were also wondering, are there health warnings that should be suggested or promulgated? I was thinking of one, and it would require people to believe it, but I think a warning to the effect that playing audio out loud on your phone on the train could have a detrimental impact on your health because fellow passengers may cave your head in.
100%. I think it should come with a warning when you start playing a YouTube video or making a video call in public transit with no headphones, that before you press, you know how Google asks you to verify you're not a robot and you're a human? Verify that you understand you might get punched in the face. That's the warning that should come with it.
It should, but surely I am now just thinking out loud. If any tech boffins are listening who can fill me in on the particulars of this, it must be possible to immobilize them so they can't play audio out loud unless they detect that headphones are connected to it.
Andrew, you speak of an utopia that I can only dream of.
Well, I do my best. Carlotta Ribello and Laura Kramer, thank you both for joining us. You're back with the Monocle Daily, and this week Monocle's team were in Hong Kong to host the Chiefs Conference, bringing together entrepreneurs, thought leaders and cultural figures from across the Asian region. Among them was the Indonesian actor and director Dian Sastrowardoyo. Her latest television series, Cigarette Girl, is on Netflix. Dian spoke with Sophie Grove, editor of Monocle's sister publication Confect, about the rise of Indonesian cinema.
Actually, we are right now in a very exciting moment, especially in the cinema world, because for the 275 million Indonesians, sadly, there's only 2,800 screens for the whole country.
I think I rounded up your population a little bit there.
Yes, I mean, like, compared to Japan's 125 million population, they already have 20,000 screens of cinemas. That's how underscreened we are. But at the moment, we are so excited and happy because our latest work, as you can see, Cigarette Girl, it's playing on Netflix. And excitingly, we are so happy that it crossed over to so many different countries. It was top 10 in a non-English speaking countries all around the world, and we are so happy because Cigarette Girl is a very local content. It's very traditional. It also speaks about feminism. It approaches, you know, sensitive subjects like patriarchy and how women wants to fight for their own rights, for their own way of, you know, determining their life. And somehow this very local and very traditional story relates in so many universal aspects of the story in it. So it was being watched by people from Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and we were really surprised ourselves that sometimes something that is very local can be very universal at the same time. And through platforms like Netflix, we can make contents that have better distributions and it can cross over towards different countries. Before there was online platforms like Netflix or Disney Plus or Amazon, we were really relying on distribution companies. So before, if you ever heard of The Raid, you know, the very phenomenal action movie that was made in Indonesia, it was acted by Indonesian actors. It highlights the Indonesian martial art. It was very good in Hollywood, in LA, but its success was solely depending on the XYZ distribution company. So the distribution is still a huge problem in terms of, you know, making sure that our content is being watched all over the world.
Well, we'll come back to some of these themes, but I wanted to really start by asking you about your own story. You've played so many iconic figures in Indonesian history on film, but you started as really a young woman, even a teenager in the industry. Give us a sense of what that journey is like and some of the challenges that you've had to overcome.
Yes, I actually started modeling like a year after my dad passed away back in 1995. And I started acting from 1999 when I was 18. So it has been a quarter of a century of a career in film just this year. So for me, it was a long way to go because I started very... Actually, the first time I started to go into the entertainment business, it was because I want to fund my own education. My biggest dream is actually to get educated abroad. Actually, I wanted to go to those Ivy League universities in the United States. And because I'm not privileged enough to be born in, you know, those privileged families, I know I need to work myself. I need to find my own money, to find my own financing. And modeling and filming was like the easiest job that a teenager can get, and it can make sense. You can actually study and sometimes film at holidays. And then the challenges is really, it varies, but it's really such a privileged opportunity for me to be able to play these characters. I played Kartini, our local hero that fought for women's right. I mean, sometimes I just talked to Pak Karim Raslan just now, and we thought about Indonesia as the biggest invisible elephant because we are so huge in the Southeast Asia, but nobody has ever heard of us. Not a lot of people knows about Indonesian and how are they like. And we are so proud that here in Monocle, the Chief Conference, we have Manoni Purnama and myself, like I'm here. I'm so happy to have this opportunity to actually introduce to you about what Indonesians are like, Indonesian women to be particular. And to be able to represent Indonesian women and tell their own stories, to give voices to those who maybe cannot tell their own stories by showing these pictures. Here, if you can see in these trailers, we are showing you some of the several of the most incredibly critically acclaimed films throughout the international festivals. You can see Tiger Stripes, people are telling more stories for women, and more women directors are telling their own stories, and it's like giving voice to those that usually they don't have any voice. You know, as Indonesia, they sometimes observe Indonesia as a conservative society because we are the largest Muslim majority country, where sometimes sensitive issues like patriarchy and feminism are not being discussed. Well, more and more films are discussing that and approaching to those subjects in a delicate manner through art. That is actually showing a very refreshing vision about how open actually Indonesians are like. I mean, sometimes through the conventional news, they see Indonesians are like just really conservative or really, you know, black and white. But actually inside Indonesia, there are so many different layers of cultures, so many different types of Indonesians that actually sees matters into a lot of different way of how they approach the culture.
And tell me about the appetite for instance, Cigarette Girl, which is a Netflix funded an amazing series, if you haven't seen it. This is a very compelling drama, but it also tells the history of Indonesia. It's really representing, you know, the arc of you know, this, actually the clove cigarette industry, but also the history of the nation, and it's about identity. Is there an appetite for investing in that type of narrative from within Indonesia and also from foreign investment?
Yes, I think for foreign investment, there hasn't been that much appetite to invest on a story that is very rooted traditionally and very rooted locally. But after Cigarette Girl, we can see that Netflix are now starting to open their eyes and now starting to approve budgets 3 times higher than last year. Because after Cigarette Girl, they kind of see that, oh, it actually works. I think the more rooted the story is, it could actually become very universal because people in different countries can relate to them.
And do you believe that film is a real force for change in Indonesia, but globally too?
I really do think that film is a force for change because through film, I think we are giving the opportunity for the audience to think and feel the same way that the director or the actors really want them to feel. And I think it's that magic in film watching when you don't really need to talk or interact with the filmmakers, but they somehow get the sense and the sensation, the emotional sensation and the intellectual sensation that they get from watching a film. And I think that's why film is magical, and film has a very, very, very special way of communicating with the audience.
That was Dian Sastrowardoyo speaking to Confect editor Sophie Grove at the Chiefs Conference in Hong Kong. You're listening to The Daily with me, Andrew Muller. And finally on today's show, country music has a long and often inglorious history of suspicion of outsiders to the genre trying their luck, and an equally hardy tradition of offering haven principally to America's rural poor and urban working classes. It is therefore a bold move for a gazillionaire superstar of the stature of Beyoncé to embrace country, but she has done exactly that on Cowboy Carter, her new album out today. Here is a bit of it.
You say stop the river from running, I'll build a dam or two. You say change religion, now I spend Sundays with you. Something about those tears of yours, how does it feel to be?
I'm joined now in the studio by studio director and producer of Monocle on Culture, Steph Chungu. Steph, you have listened to this album more than once already.
Yes, 2.5 times, thank you.
2.5 times. A summary of your thoughts thereon.
She's done it again. Stunning. Absolutely stunning. No, I kind of was expecting her to do a country album, especially after 2016. So a little bit of a throwback. So this is her 8th album. It kind of stemmed from the CMAs. So in 2016, mm-hmm. she released Lemonade, which is an already stunning album. Should have won all the Grammys. She was a surprise guest at the CMAs in 2016. She performed Daddy's Lessons, which is the only country track on Lemonade, with the Chicks, formerly Dixie Chicks. That was According to platforms and blogs, that was like the biggest, highest rated 15 minutes of CMAs ever. And it met with a lot of scrutiny and a lot of backlash from conservative country fans, shall we say.
Angry morons, I think, is the phrase you're looking for.
You said it, not me. They took it down and then they uploaded it again after they faced a lot of backlash from, obviously, Beyonce fans and music heads, just saying, like, it's one of your biggest 15 minutes. Why are you taking it down? We didn't really see how that really affected her. She went straight on to just doing whatever, and then obviously lockdown happened. But then after releasing Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, straight after that insane Verizon advert, she kind of confirmed the album was a reflection of that experience. She said on her Instagram, "This album has been over 5 years in the making. It was born out of an experience that I had years ago where I did not feel welcomed, and it was very clear I wasn't. But because of that experience, I did a deeper dive into the history of country music and studied our rich musical archive." And here we are, 2 weeks later, 27 songs long, including interludes.
That was the point she was just making, that she had, this is not a dilettantish whim. She has gone into this quite deeply, and there's collaborations on the album with, like, proper people off country music's Mount Rushmore, Dolly Parton, Willie Nelson, and within the lyrics and within the music, there's a lot of throwbacks to country's history, and that in itself is a very country thing to do. There's basically an entire minor country subgenre of country music about other country music, and she does seem to be contributing to that as well.
Yeah, she does, with obviously the pioneers of country music, of course. There's also Miley Cyrus, who I believe is related to Dolly Parton, which is amazing, and also up-and-comers, Tana Adele, Britney Spencer, Tiara Kennedy, and Raina Roberts, and Shabuzi, and of course Rhiannon Giddens, who you interviewed in the past on Big Interview.
I did.
It was a really great interview.
It was. That is on our website, and I am still hoping she will come back and bring her banjo with her.
I hope so. But it was a really great gateway for her to bridge, basically, her roots. Obviously, she's from Houston, Texas, and country music as a whole, because country music did essentially start in a small town in Texas with artists of color, but for some reason it has been erased in country's history. Like, thankfully, you know, we have artists of color like bridging that gap and bringing country with a diverse and a beautiful range of artists and musicians. And as well as that, she wanted to reflect that with her style of country music and her, you know, her little Beyonce twist on it. When you listen to the album, because I'm going to force you to do it, I don't care, I'm doing it. I really want to hear your take on her interpretation of Dolly Parton's Jolene, to which that Jolene predicted, or she knew, 2 years ago that Beyonce was going to cover it on the Daily Show. And look what happened. And there's various covers as well. She covers the Beatles' Blackbird, which I think is going down a tree. I don't know. I mean, I don't have the inside knowledge in Paul McCartney HQ, but I'm sure he's enjoying it. There's also references to Linda Artel as well. It's just a beautiful classic album, and everyone's raving about it. I'm just, you know, when you just think, is this enough for all the awards people? Because obviously, you know, she's won so many accolades at the Grammys and all the variation and all the other awards adjacent to that. But the one thing that she hasn't secured is record and album of the year, which her husband Jay-Z made a very valid point to I think it's a couple months ago at the previous Grammys. So my question is this enough to let her actually get what she deserves? Because she deserves this. She's been deserving this for years. Ever since Lemonade, she's been deserving Album of the Year. All the recipients from 2016 onwards have been saying Beyonce deserves that this award, from Adele to Taylor Swift. The list goes on and on. So is Cowboy Carter enough? I hope so. I really do.
Just a final thought, though, because it is being billed very much as Beyonce's country album, but it is also very recognisably, from what I have heard of it, a Beyonce album. She hasn't subsumed herself entirely in generic tropes. She has made country music meet her on her own terms. And in within the Beyoncé pantheon, where do you rate it? Is it up there with her great albums?
I think it is. I will say I don't think she wants to class it as a country album because when she revealed the official artwork of it 2 weeks ago, she said this ain't a country album. This is a Beyoncé album. This is Act 2 Cowboy Carter, and I'm proud to share it with y'all. So I wouldn't class it as a country. I mean, obviously
it's a pretty country looking cover.
It is a country looking cover. Yes. Does she want to label it country? I don't know, but in the whole like trilogy of the acts, I mean, this is Act 2. We don't know what Act 3 is. I'm hoping it's a rock album because she's been mentioning a lot of mosh pits. So my emo heart is ready for Act 3. But I think this could be one of her magnus opus, if you say. I think it's way on the high there with Lemonade. I think it is going to be one of the many albums that many, dare I say it, country fans will refer back to once they've listened to it.
Steph Chungu, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our other panellists today, Carlotta Ribello, Laura Kramer and Hannah Lucinda Smith. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by Monica Lillis. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin, with editing assistance from Sarah Nicol and Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening and happy Easter.